train. I'm locked in tight, my brain. Have I been the chain?
Well, here we are, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Today is the 6th of November, 2018. It's a Monday. You're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. Got about 7 minutes after 9 a.m. Arizona time. Your mind is your primary weapon. This is the first day of change of the clock. I know, it always seems so odd. Everybody else changes, but there's 3 or 4 states that don't and fall back in the fall, spring forward in the spring, but tried to come up with a couple of analogies, and usually everybody's a little bit more confused afterwards. So needless to say, in the last 6 months or so, we've been starting at 8 a.m. Arizona time, and now we're starting at 9 a.m. If I stand in one place and everybody else changes, cover a little bit today about Lawrence of Arabia, Thomas Edward Lawrence, the at that time the most of the attention was over in the trench warfare in World War I, and not a whole lot was being paid to what was going on in the Middle East. And some of the tactics, techniques, and procedures, the TTP, that Lawrence came up with, I can't find any historical evidence that he had picked it up because this is the way the quote-unquote British Army did things. And the modern use in today's vernacular, close air support and artillery and armored vehicles and things, at that time, they were unheard of. And it certainly appears to me that Lawrence had basically thought these things up and did them on his own. He wasn't ordered to. They started off as a rather ragtag band. People had never encountered airplanes and machine guns and explosives. But they caught on real quick. And so it's quite interesting of a study. Now, a lot of these things that had happened just a tad over 100 years ago, and it's quite instructive in our study of insurgency, of what we're trying to achieve here on Your Mind is Your Primary Weapon. I'll get into Lawrence here a little bit. I send this broadcast out to Lily Grace Antoinette. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com, and that's Alpha Lima Tango Hotel Alpha Bravo Echo Bravo 762@hotmail.com. Have a couple of items of border news I'd like to bring to your attention. I've been talking about the trial of El Chapo Guzman Larrea on some of the different broadcasts, and being that his trial starts today, I just kind of found it odd here for the longest time that, no, number one, the mainstream news media certainly made a big deal out of it when he escaped from prison, when he was captured, and when he was extradited. And I suspect because of this convoy, that's the last thing they want to talk about is, you know, interrelate criminality and convoy and south of the border and stuff. And yesterday, I had gone up on a show and brought these points out. I'll monitor them to see if anybody else picks up on the information. But it was quite odd here on the local AM station, 550 AM KFYI. They have a news dump in the AM, and they actually mentioned El Chapo. I monitored the news because they have it at the top and the bottom of the hour. But basically all they're doing is talking about the election. And he said, she said, blah, 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 who cares? So it's kind of interesting that at least they did. And they usually in the morning before the sun comes up, they're on low power and staticky and low-powered signal, and sometimes it's kind of hard to hear. But it certainly appeared to me they were saying something about, you know, well, cartels and the trial, and I think they alluded to the head of the Sinaloa cartel. And it's all right. I understand. The listeners of this broadcast and the one that we have over on the Micro Effect on Thursday and Friday understand that El Chapo is not and never has been the head of the Sinaloa cartel. A minor, yep, who cares? But, you know, when we're trying to tell the truth, and certainly that's what the information has always been, but this is part of the deception of these things. There's an article, and I've mentioned it before, but just for the sake of, BorderlandBeat.com, 3 July 2018, El Chapo, not leader of Sinaloa. That's just kind of my abbreviated handwriting or note-taking purposes. And so it's interesting in that aspect because that it does have the federal government's information that they turned over to El Chapo's defense attorneys of what they planned on presenting in. So it's not just some news reporter making information up. It's actually excerpts out of the federal government's indictment against Shorty. So, for what it's worth, sometimes we have to hold the people accountable, and sometimes it's kind of humorous also to listen to some of the other broadcasts on the things. Brought this up before about this kooky stuff about Jade Helm. I heard somebody call into a network last week and they tried to connect the convoy coming up from Mexico and Jade Helm, and the talk show host let the person say what they wanted to say, and then they, well, here, let me tell you this, that this is what the deal was, and oh, if you look at the map, the place in Texas, that was hostile, and Utah was hostile, and this place was this, and Orange County was that, and but if you turn the map sideways, it resembles a map of the Middle East, and oh, it was all designed as a psyop to get the American people to hate the military, and I don't know, kind of reminds me of a couple of years ago that the people that wouldn't know the difference between an insurgency and a bowling ball, but all of a sudden they were experts by looking at a map. I noticed that very few times they mentioned Arizona, even though that's where the headquarters of this whole force was going to be. But it had to be Texas, you know, Texas tough guys, Texas independents were a seat of hostility and blah, blah, blah. I found it. And then there's the turn the map sideways and, but anyway, I don't even see that it would even be worthwhile to try to help educate these people. Mastering the human domain and mastering the human terrain. Pudentain, rain in Spain, ask me again, I'll tell you the same. Because anybody that's been listening to your mind as your primary weapon for any length of time, that by just a close examination of the map, without even reading the bullet points on what was released about Jade Helm, closely looking, not sitting here fixated on Texas or Arizona or Utah or California or all the rest of that minutia. But if you look at just the very bottom part of California, that it said that it was a pocket of insurgency. So then we, through extrapolation, we would see that what Jade Helm was, if you will, quote-unquote, a counter-insurgent warfare, and as opposed to conventional war. So, when we discussed the part, now, a while back, and I'm sure they're still doing it, in an intelligence analyst job, is to study the enemy forces in a conventional force. Their artillery, their guns, their planes, their trucks, all the way down to how long a pair of boots would last so if people had to walk, how they would have to be logistically supplied to maintain their momentum. And that's the focus of that part. But in an insurgency, the strategic terrain is the people. Strategic terrain, strategic domain, mastering the human domain. We covered quite a bit of the concept of the human domain and gave quite a few examples of that previously. Maybe it'd be worthwhile to cover that over again for the benefit of the new listeners, but and also try what I'm going to attempt to do is to tell you in the beginning of what we're going to talk about, and then we're going to talk about it, and then afterwards we're going to review of what we talked about. It's kind of reinforcing the lesson, if you will. And so today we're going to talk a little bit about insurgency and specifically Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Edward Lawrence, known to the world as Lawrence of Arabia. Now, also a couple other items I'd like to cover here. We've got about 10 minutes or so before the bottom. Robert Miner, his telephone is 701-251-2365. 701-251-2365. You know, Veterans Day is coming up here, 11-11. So maybe just two, because Robert Miner had been a member of our armed forces. Maybe you could send him a Veterans Day greeting. Try to use the word, don't let the communists get you down, because I guess from hearing some of these telephone conversations between Bob and Hardway that been playing on the Intel report in the afternoons, that it certainly upsets these people to be referred to as communists. Also mentioning about the Intel report, you've been covering over there what I refer to as 72 articles, my observations from conducting operations in the Southwest Desert on what to do, what not to do, and how to go about it. And it's been received very well. Now, it made plans to go up in the afternoon on Friday, but it was like an aquarium filled with very hungry piranha, and I wasn't going to stick my arm in that one. So hopefully this afternoon we can maybe get back to some of those things. I have to set my clock differently. Yeah, right. And being that we're going to that 6 months ago when we cut the foot off of the blanket and sewed it on the other end, now we're going to pull those stitches out and sew the blanket foot section back up at the other end of the blanket so we can do all this crazy clock stuff one of these days, time permitting. Give some information on why Arizona said that that's just a giant waste of time and decided not to do that. Liberty Tree Radio, telephone number is 712-432-0900. 712-432-0900. Mechanical voice comes along, asks you to enter the room number, 957-464, pound sign, 957-464, the pound sign. Also, the website is libertytreeradio.4mg.com. And now that we're in the last 2 months of the year, it's very important, because if they're able to collect the funds to pay next year's bill for the bandwidth or the web service or however that is, then it's a considerable savings if you pay it ahead of time. So I'm asking you to please help keep Liberty Tree Radio on the air. That is, if it's worth it to you, or one of these days you'll turn on Liberty Tree Radio and there will be nothing there. We all do our part. So without much further ado, we'll start talking a little bit about the evolution of a revolt that occurred just a little bit over 100 years ago. And it's quite instructive of how to conduct an insurgency and some of the concepts of what Lawrence had come up with. Because the Arab revolt began in June of 1916 with an Arab offensive. It was a surprise attack by the half-armed and inexperienced tribesmen upon the Turkish garrisons in Medina and Mecca. And they had no success. And after a few days' effort, they withdrew out of range of the fort's artillery and began a blockade. And that method forced the early surrender of Mecca, whose road communications were too long and rough to be held by the Turks. Medina, however, was linked by railway to the Turkish main army in Syria, and thanks to their superior numbers and equipment, the Turks were able, in a week's fighting, to restore the line and reinforce the temporarily besieged garrison there. The Arab forces, which had attacked it, fell back gradually as the Turks became more offensive, and at last moved 50 miles southwest into the hills, and there they took up a position across the main road to Mecca. Now, at that point, the campaign stood still for many weeks. While both sides breathed, the Turks prepared to take the initiative by sending an expeditionary force to Mecca to crush the revolt where it had started. Now, they moved an army corps to Medina by rail, and strengthened it beyond establishment with guns, cars, airplanes, machine guns, and quantities of horses, mule, and camel transport. Then they began to advance down the main western road from Medina to Mecca. Now, the total distance was about 250 miles. Now, the first 50 miles were easy, and then came a belt of hills 20 miles wide, and which were Faisal's, the tribesmen, standing on the defensive. Now, after the hills was a level stretch for 70 miles along the coastal plain to Rabug, rather more than halfway. Now, Rabug is a little port on the Red Sea with good anchorage for ships. Now, in it was Sharif Ali's, Faisal's eldest brother, with more tribal forces and the beginnings of an Arab regular army. And they were recruited from officers and men of Arab blood who had served in the Turkish army and were now willing to fight against their old masters for their national freedom. Now, the British military advisors had said that Rabug was the key of Mecca, since no hostile force could pass along the main road without occupying it and watering at its wells under the palm trees. Now, its defense was therefore the main importance. The Navy could cooperate effectively from the harbor, and the circle of the palm groves must be laid out as an entrenched position and held by regular troops. And the British thought that the Bedouin tribesmen would never be of any value in a fixed position, and that therefore an Arab regular force must be formed and trained as soon as possible to undertake the duty. Now, if the Turks advanced before the new force was ready, the British would have to lend a brigade of British or Allied troops to serve the Sharif in his extremity by maintaining the stop block. Now, Lawrence took a personal reconnaissance of the Arab positions there and in the hills where Faisal was, and it caused him to modify the views of the experts slightly. Now, Faisal had some thousands of men all armed with rifles, rather casual, distrustful fellows, but very active and cheerful. but they were posted in the hills and defiles of such natural strength that it seemed to Lawrence very improbable that the Turks could force them just by their superior numbers, for in some ways it's easier to defend a range of hills against 9 or 10,000 men than against 9 or 10. So accordingly, Lawrence reported that the tribesmen, if strengthened by light machine guns and regular officers as advisors, they should be able to hold up the Turkish indefinitely while the Arab regular force was being created. As was almost inevitable in view of the general course of the military thinking since Napoleon, they all looked only to the regulars to win the war. The British were obsessed by the dictums of Foch that the ethic of modern war is to seek for the enemy's army and his center of power and destroy it in battle. And irregulars would not attack positions, and so they seemed incapable of forcing a decision. Now, while the British were training the regulars, of course not sending officers or light machine guns to Faisal in the hills, the Turks suddenly hit Lawrence's appreciation to the test by beginning their advance on Mecca. They broke through the impregnable hills in 24 hours and came forward for them towards Rabugh slowly. So they proved that the second theorem of irregular warfare, namely that irregular forces are as unable to defend a point or a line as they are to attack it. Now, that lesson was received by the British quite without gratitude, for the Turkish success put the British and the Arabs in a crucial position. The Rabugh force was not capable of repelling the attack of a single battalion, much less of a corps. Now, it was nearly impossible to send down British troops from Egypt at the moment, nor did Lawrence think that a single British brigade would have been capable of holding all of Rabugh's position, nor was the Rabugh position indispensable to the Turks, nor would a single Arab have remained with the Sharif if he introduced British troops into the Hijaz. Now, in the emergency, it occurred to Lawrence that perhaps the virtue of irregulars lay in depth, not in face, and that it had been the threat of attack by them upon the Turkish northern flank which had made the enemy hesitate for so long. Now, the actual Turkish flank then ran from their front line in Medina, a distance of some 50 miles, but if the British moved towards the Hijaz railway behind Medina, they might stretch out the threat and accordingly their flank as far potentially as Damascus, 800 miles away to the north. And such a move would force the Turks to the defensive and they might regain the initiative. So anyhow, it seemed that their only chance. And so in January of 1917, they took all of Faisal's tribesmen and turned their backs on Mecca, Rabugh, and the Turks, and marched away north 200 miles to Wedge. And thanks to the help of the British Red Sea Fleet, which fed and watered them along the coast and gave them gunpowder and a landing party at their objective. Now, the eccentric movement acted like a charm. Now, Clausewitz had said that rear guards modulate the enemy's action like a pendulum, but not by what they do, but by their mere existence. Remember when we were discussing the 72 articles last week, the occupation is a deterrence. Just by merely being there, your mere existence acts like a pendulum. Now, so they did nothing concrete, but their march recalled the Turks who were almost into Rabugh all the way back to Medina, and there they have their force. Now, one half took up the entrenched position about the city, which they held until after the armistice, and the other half was distributed along the railway to defend it against their threat. And for the rest of the war, the Turks stood on the defensive against the Arabs, and they won the advantage over the advantage till when the peace came, that they had taken 35,000 prisoners, killed and wounded, and worn out about as many, and occupied 100,000 square miles of the enemy's territory at little loss to the Arabs. Very important lessons here. Very, very important lessons in the strategy of the insurgent, because the insurgent has the upper hand. He decides where to attack and when to attack. And the government security forces, never knowing where the insurgent is going to attack, then they have to guard everywhere. And like we've pointed out, especially in our lesson on the War of the Flea, if you guard everywhere, you guard nowhere. Victims of Sun Tzu and also of Field Marshal Erwin Rommel. Now, however, they were not aware then that Wedge was the turning point. And the British thought that they had come to it to cut the railway, and Lawrence was at once sent up country to do this as a means to take Medina. Now, the Turkish headquarters and the main garrison. Now, on the way up, he fell ill and spent 10 days on his back in a tent without anything to do except to think about war and analysis of the hitherto empirical practice for its real import. Now, Lawrence was unfortunately as much in charge of the campaign as he pleased and had no training in command to outfit him for that type of work. So in military theory, he was tolerably read for curiosity in his Oxford years before they had taken him past Napoleon to Clausewitz and his school to Cemeray, I guess that's how you pronounce it, Caemmerer, and Moltke to Goltz and the recent Frenchman. Now, these, to Lawrence, they had seemed very partial books. And after a look at Jomini and Willison, Lawrence found broader principles in the 18th century in Saxe, Gilbert, and their followers. However, Clausewitz was intellectually so much the master of them all that unwillingly Lawrence came to believe in him. Now, tactically, the only campaigns that Lawrence had studied step by step were the ancient affairs of Hannibal and Belisarius, Muhammad, and the Crusades. And his interests were only in pure theory, and he looked everywhere for the metaphysical side, the philosophy of war, about which he had thought a little for some years. But now, being that he was deathly ill and pretty much in a tent for 10 days, he was compelled suddenly to action, to find an immediate equation between his book reading and the present movements. So the books gave Lawrence the aim in war quite pat, as they would say, the destruction of the organized forces of the enemy by the one process battle. Victory could only be purchased by blood. This is a hard saying for them, as the Arabs had no organized forces, and so a Turkish folk would have had no aim. And the Arabs would not endure casualties, so that an Arab Clausewitz could not buy his victory. Now, the wise men must be talking metaphors, Lawrence was thinking, because for they, the Arabs, were indubitably winning their war. And as he thought about it, it dawned on Lawrence that they had already won the Hejaz War, because they were in occupation of 99% of the Hejaz. The Turks were welcome to the other fraction until peace or doomsday showed them the futility of clinging to their window pane. So that part of the war was over, so why bother about Medina? It was no base for the Arabs, like Rabugh, and no threat to the Turks, like Wedge. Just a blind alley for both. So the Turks sat in it on the defensive, immobile, eating for food their transport animals, which were to have moved them to Mecca, but for which there was no pasture in their own restricted lines. And they were harmless sitting there. If we took them prisoner, they would cost us food and guards in Egypt. And if we drove them out northwards into Syria, they would join the main army blocking us, the Arabs, in Sinai. And on all counts, they were best where they were, and they valued Medina and wanted to keep it. So let them. And this all seemed to Lawrence unlike the ritual of war for which folk had been priests, and so Lawrence began to hope that there was a difference of kind between the Arabs and folk. And he called his modern war absolute, because in it, two nations professing incompatible philosophies, they set out to try them in the light of force, and a struggle of two immaterial principles could only end when the supporters of one had no more means of resistance, and the option can be argued with a conviction is best shot. The logical end of the war of creeds is the final destruction of one, and as Salambo, the classical textbook, incense. Now, these are the lines of the struggle between France and Germany, but not, Lawrence thought, between Germany and England, for all efforts to make their men hate the enemy just made them hate the war, and later on by the armistice, we had made the Great War fall short of the folk ideal. So to Lawrence, it seemed only a variety of war, and it could then see other sorts, as Clausewitz had numbered them, personal wars for dynastic reasons, expulsive wars for party reasons, or commercial wars for trading reasons. And so then Lawrence thought of the Arab aim and saw that it was geographical to occupy all Arabic-speaking lands in Asia, and in doing of it that they might kill the Turks, because we disliked them very much. The Arabs had been under the Turkish boot for 500 years, and they were a little upset. But yet the killing of the Turks would never be an excuse or an aim, because if they would go quietly, the war would end. But if not, we would try to drive them out, and in the last resort, we would be compelled to the desperate course of blood, now on the maxim of murder war, but as cheaply as possible for the Arabs, since the Arabs were fighting for freedom, a pleasure only to be tasted by a man alive. So Lawrence's personal duty was to command, and he began to unravel command and analyze it, both from the point of view of strategy, the aim of war, the synoptic regard, which sees everything by the standard of the whole, and from the point of the view called tactics, the means towards the strategic end, the steps of its staircase. Now, in each, Lawrence found the same elements, one algebraic, one biological, a third psychological. The first seemed a pure science, subject to the laws of mathematics without humanity, because it dealt with known invariables, fixed conditions, space and time, inorganic things like hills and climates and railways, with mankind in tight masses, too great for individual variety, with all artificial aids, and the extensions given their facilities by mechanical invention. It was essentially formulable. Now, in the Arab case, the algebraic factor would take first account of the area that they wished to conquer. So he began idly to calculate how many square miles, perhaps 140,000, and how would the Turks defend all of that? No doubt by a trench line across the bottom. Now, if they were an army attacking with banners displayed, but suppose that the Arabs were an influence, as they might be, an idea, a thing invulnerable, intangible, without front or back, drifting about like a gas. Armies were like plants, immobile as a whole, firm-rooted, nourished through long stems to the head. So Lawrence thought that they might be a vapor blowing where they listed. Our kingdoms lay in each man's mind, and as we wanted nothing material to live on, so perhaps they offered nothing material to the killing. So it seemed a regular soldier might be helpless without a target. He would then own the ground he sat on and what he could poke his rifle at. And the next step, that Lawrence estimated how many posts they would need to contain the attack in depth. Sedition putting up her head in every unoccupied one of the 100,000 square miles. And Lawrence knew that the Turkish army inside out, and allowing for its recent extension of faculty by guns and airplanes and armored trains, still it seemed it would have had a need of a fortified post every 4 square miles, and a post could not be less than 20 men. So the Turks would need 600,000 men to meet the combined ill wills of all the local Arabs, and they had only 100,000 men available. So it seemed the assets in that part of command were the Arabs, and the climate, railways, deserts, technical weapons could also be attached to the Arabs' interests if they realized their raw materials and were apt with them. The Turk was stupid and would believe that rebellion was absolute, like war, and deal with it on an analogy of absolute warfare. Analogy is fudge, anyhow, and to make war upon rebellion is messy and slow, like eating soup with a knife. So much for the mathematical elements, which Lawrence annoyed the others by calling hecastics. And now the second factor was biological, the breaking point, life and death, or better, wear and tear. Bionomics seemed a good name for it, and the war philosophers had properly made it an art and had elevated one item in it, the effusion of blood, to the height of a principle. It became humanity in battle, an art touching every side of the corporal being and very war. There was a line of variability, man, running through all its estimates. Its components were sensitive and illogical, and generals guarded themselves by the device of a reserve, the significant medium of their art. Now, Goltz had said that when you know the enemy's strength and he is fully deployed, then you know enough to dispose with a reserve. But that is never. There is always the possibility of accident or some flaw in materials present in the general's mind, and the reserve is unconsciously held to meet it. There is a felt element in troops, not expressible in figures, guesses, by what the equivalent of, as Plato would say. And the greatest commander is he whose intuitions most nearly happen. Now, nine-tenths of tactics are certain and taught in books, but the irrational tenth is like the kingfisher flashing across the pool, and that is the test of generals. It can only be ensured by instinct, sharpened by thought, practicing the stroke so often that the crisis is as natural as a reflex. Yet, to limit the art to humanity seemed to Lawrence an undue narrowing down, and it must apply to materials as much as to organism. Now, in the Turkish army, materials were scarce and precious. Men were plentiful, more plentiful than equipment, and consequently, their cue should be to destroy not the army, but the materials. And this is another classic, because nowadays, what's referred to as the center of gravity, and Lawrence had obviously figured it out, because in the Turkish army, the materials were scarce and precious, and the men were more plentiful than equipment, so consequently, their cue was to destroy not the army, not the men, but their materials. And the death of a Turkish bridge or rail, machine or a gun or high explosive was more profitable to the Arabs than the death of a Turk. And the Arab army just at that time was equally chary of men and materials. And the men, because they were being irregulars, were not units but individuals. And an individual casualty is like a pebble dropped in the water. And each may make only a brief hole that rings of sorrow widen out from there. And they could not afford casualties. Materials were easier to deal with and put straight. But the British's obvious duty was to make themselves superior in some one branch, whether it was gun cotton or machine guns or whatever could be made most decisive. Now, Foch had laid down the maxim, applying it to men, of being superior at the critical point and the moment of attack. But Lawrence thought that they might apply it to materials and be superior in equipment in one dominant moment or respect. Now, that's just taking all these things and turning them over on their heads, because once again, Lawrence was well read in his spare time at Oxford, reading about some of these people like Foch or Jomini, Clausewitz, but he really had not gone to Sandhurst and became a military officer. The only reason he got in the military was because he had traveled in the land and knew the language and knew the people and their customs and their tribes. He tried to enlist in the British Army, but he was too short. They didn't want him. And then the people that had gotten enlisted into the British military and set up over in Egypt were a lot of the people that had been the curators of the museum or the people that had traveled extensively over in the Middle East. Now, for both men and things that Lawrence thought that they might try to give folk doctrine a negative twisted side for a cheapness of sake and be weaker than the enemy everywhere except in one point or matter, because most wars are war of contact, both forces striving to keep in touch to avoid a tactical surprise. But Lawrence thought that their war should be a war of detachment, because they were to contain the enemy, but the salient threat of a vast unknown desert not disclosing themselves till the moment of the attack. Now, the attack need be only nominal, directed not against his men, but against his material. Once again, he's attacking their center of gravity. So it should not seek for the main strength of his weakness, but for his most accessible material. In railway cutting, this would be usually an empty stretch of rail, and that was a tactical success. And they might turn the average into a rule, not a law. A war is antimonium, said Colin, and at length this should develop an unconscious habit of never engaging the enemy at all. Never engaging the enemy at all. And that chimed with the numerical plea of never giving the enemy soldier a target. Many Turks on their front had no chance at all to fire a shot at the Arabs, and correspondingly, they were never on the defensive, except by a rare accident. And the corollary of such a rule was perfectly intelligence, so that they could plan in complete certainty. Now, the chief agent had to be the general's head, and his knowledge had to be faultless, leaving no room for chance. So the Arabs took more pains in that service than in any other staff that Lawrence had seen. Now, the third factor in command seems to be the psychological. That science, say, Xenophon called it dialectic, of which their propaganda is a strained and ignoble part. Now, some of it concerns the crowd, the adjustment of spirit, to the point where it becomes fit to exploit in actions. The prearrangement of a changing option in a certain end. And some of it deals with individuals, and then it becomes a rare art of human kindness, transcending, by purposeful emotion, the gradual logical sequence of their mind. Now, it considers the capacity of mood of the men, of the complexities, and the mutability, and the cultivation of what is then profits the intention, because they had to arrange their minds in order of battle just as carefully and as formally as other officers arrange their bodies, and not only of the Arabs' men's minds, though them first, the minds of the enemy, and so far as they could reach them, and thirdly, the mind of the nation supporting them behind the firing line, and the mind of the hostile nation awaiting the verdict, and the neutrals looking on. Your mind is your primary weapon. Now, it was the ethical in war and the process on which the Arabs mainly depended for victory on the Arab front. The printing press is the greatest weapon in the armory of a modern commander. And we, the Arabs, being amateurs in the art of command, began their war in the atmosphere of the 20th century and thought of their weapons without prejudice, not distinguishing one from another socially. The regular officer has the tradition of 40 generations of serving soldiers behind him, and to him, the old weapons are the most honored. But Lawrence and the Arabs had seldom to concern themselves with what their men did, but much with what they thought, and to them, the dialectic was more than half command. Now, in Europe, was set a little aside and entrusted to men outside the general staff in Asia, where they were so weak physically that they could not let the metaphysical weapon rust unused, that they had won a province when they had taught the civilians in it to die for ideal of freedom, and the presence or absence of the enemy was a secondary matter. Now, I see we're right up at the very top. I hope you're comprehending the points that I'm trying to make. These are classic principles, and then we come to the conclusion or the realization that Lawrence made these things up 100 years ago. He had read some of these people, but there was something missing in his cause. And about the Arabs' cause, on how we're going to do this. And it's like, yeah, well, that makes sense over here, but this isn't there. This is a completely different creature. We're not going to just sit here and crash these two armies together. You guys stand on that side of the bridge, and we'll stand on this side of the bridge, and we'll just start shooting at each other until we either run out of people or we run out of ammunition, kind of like the way that the British were thinking in 1776. I guess that didn't work out real good either. So we're covering over some classic principles on insurgency at reviewing the book, The Road Not Taken, by Max Boot about Lansdale. In the beginning, it makes frequent references to Lawrence. And so the point is we have to join together with the band. Now, sometimes we don't always dig what somebody else does or says, but there's plenty of room. You guys operate on the east side of the road, we'll operate on the west side of the road. Because the cause is bigger than ourselves. The nation is on fire, and we all need to pitch in this bucket brigade. Let's get her done, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for being with us on Liberty Tree Radio, and please help support Liberty Tree Radio. I'll see you Thursday on The Micro Effect. Same bat time, same bat station. Later.